I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Chris Metzler. He's the director of the documentary Everyday Sunshine, The Story of Fishbone, which opens this Friday at the CCA in Santa Fe and also at the Guild Cinema in Albuquerque and the Taos Center for the Arts. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks again for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So this is a group, I mean, I feel sort of out of it because everybody I know, once I start asking, knows about Fishbone. I didn't know about Fishbone, but they were a phenomenon. They were something that I didn't even know existed, a black punk group that came up in the 1980s. Who were they? How did this whole Fishbone phenomenon happen?
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting. I mean, this band Fishbone started in the late 70s. The kind of dreams of these junior high kids, six black kids that were living in South Central, got bused to the white suburbs and quickly fell in love with punk rock. And so they started putting on great shows and mixing all these different genres, and they really kind of changed the Southern California music scene that went on to spawn the Red Hot Chili Peppers and No Doubt and Sublime, and all those bands were heavily influenced by Fishbone, but Fishbone kind of always stuck out based on them being black, but then also just the really crazy music they put on.
So it is really crazy music, and we're going to hear some just at the end of the show, but they were perhaps unique in the way that they kind of mixed genres together. What were some of their different influences?
Fishbone's kind of one of those like undefinable bands because they mix so many different types of musics together. So they do punk and ska and reggae and heavy metal, and just kind of throw everything into the mix. And so they kind of were influenced by everybody, and then they kind of made their own unique sound.
They're such an interesting group of characters, and especially this guy, Angelo Moore, who is just a total genius.
Yeah, he definitely has the artistic personality. He's the lead singer of Fishbone and also plays saxophones. But when he plays saxophones, he's not just playing one saxophone. There's probably about six or seven different size saxes, from a small little one to the one the size of a human being that he plays during a show. And he's a guy that really takes the kind of punk rock ethos to heart, not only the way he lives his personal life, but also during a show, in the sense that usually within the first couple minutes of Fishbone's show, he'll be out there stage diving, joining the mosh pit, and probably half naked in about 5 minutes. So as you can imagine, that's why Fishbone became this kind of cult following in the 80s and early 90s, is because you went to a Fishbone show, you were seeing something that no other band did. And so that's one of the reasons why, even to this day, you'll talk to a lot of people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and they'll say, the best concert I ever saw in my life was Fishbone.
It was fascinating to me that these black kids who were bused from parts of L.A. that were really, basically totally African-American parts of the city to these white suburbs. And the movie, I think, deals very nicely with this whole aspect of racism and community and the way L.A. was divided up and all of that. But the way they embraced punk rock to deal with some of the stuff they were dealing with as black people in Los Angeles, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that's the real reason why we were attracted to making this film, is that, one is that, hey, look, here's this legendary band that, influenced, basically were trendsetters and influenced a lot of today's popular musicians, but you could also explore these larger, kind of historical and cultural issues of the black community in L.A., ranging from, the crack epidemic and, gang warfare in South Central in the 1980s and the L.A. riots, but then also Fishbone's made up of a bunch of wacky guys, so just telling their story of this kind of friendship that's endured amidst all these difficulties over the last 30 years was exciting too.
There's this one moment where Angelo discovers the theremin. Now, I don't know if everybody who's listening knows what a theremin is, but it's this instrument that makes these sort of how would you describe the sound? Kind of monster movie?
Actually, the theme song for Star Trek is done on the theremin.
Right, exactly. And so Angelo discovers this and just goes bananas, much to the chagrin of his musical colleagues.
Yeah, definitely kind of threw people for a loop, because when you look at the theremin, it doesn't even look like an instrument. It's like these two antennas, and it's like this force field that goes between it, and you stick your hand in it, and that's how you control it. But there's some really wacky noises, and it's not really for everything. But to someone like Angelo, he's just like, hey, the crazier the better. And that's kind of his personality.
And yet that moment in the film, in a lot of ways, was emblematic of the kind of turmoil and personality conflicts that came up in the band that really didn't bode very well for their success.
Absolutely. I mean, I think kind of an outsider, I've never been in a band before, but like most bands, there's kind of, one person that kind of leads the band. We often, on the outside, think it's the lead singer, but usually it's somebody else. And, you know, they make the decisions and they write the songs and they're kind of like the manager, you know, or at least the personal manager. But, Fishbone was a band that kind of formed on these kind of democratic principles of like everybody was equal, everybody got a say. And that meant that everybody's kind of own personal favorites got mixed into it. And that's not the most sustainable way when you have like six people all kind of having equal say. It led to some really fantastic music, but it also, that wouldn't surprise you on the burnout rate that, Fishbone kind of has slowly kind of dropped members over the years. But Angelo and Norwood are always the kind of wackiest, craziest guys, so it's also no surprise that they're the guys that keep on doing it.
So have they been doing it unbroken since, what was it, 1980? Whatever. I mean, well, they started in junior high school, but I mean, have they been going ever since then?
Yeah, so the band formed in junior high in 1979. Their first EP came out in 84, 85. And yeah, since they were officially released an album on a record label, now it's been 25, 26 years, and they continue nonstop. I mean, they have never had a break during that entire time. I mean, they're on the road a good three quarters of the year, out there playing and just kind of rocking it hard.
They're very influential. You've got a lot of super famous people in the movie talking about how influential they were on them as musicians, as performers, and yet Fishbone never really made it big. They never made the money. Why not?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, that's kind of always the quandary with Fishbone. It's kind of the mystery we explore, and then there's no real answer other than, one is that, the music industry, specifically with popular radio, you need to have really streamlined sounds for your songs and be easily categorizable. And when you're a band that, plays ska, punk, funk, heavy metal, reggae, it makes it a little bit difficult. Also, being a black band in a predominantly white scene made it difficult. There was their own kind of like personal self-destruction mechanisms. And in some ways, Fishbone probably just was ahead of its time. And a lot of the music we hear nowadays, blends lots of genres, and that's kind of pretty common. But one of the reasons why it's common today is because a band like Fishbone came ahead and laid the groundwork. So in some ways, if Fishbone came today, they probably would be more successful. But in the same time, if they came today, then we probably wouldn't have the same sort of, kind of music we do.
Who were some of the musicians who you think are most influenced by them?
Well, I think some of the kind of top groups that are influenced by Fishbone are, folks like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and No Doubt and Sublime, but also bands like Outkast and also Black Eyed Peas. Heck, even like, Chuck D of Public Enemy, was, the hip-hop artist was, influenced by Fishbone and kind of admired what they were doing. And so, as you can see, it kind of runs the gamut, and we got a chance to interview a lot of these people in the film, whether it be Flea or Gwen Stefani or Ice-T. These are all people that not only kind of shared their love of Fishbone's music, but also knew them personally as friends, and that's the reason why it was really excited to kind of make this film. We kind of tried to make a music documentary that you didn't have to know about the music, and you didn't even have to be familiar with it to hopefully enjoy the film, in the sense that it's really a story for, people who are outsiders, who just want to be their individual selves and carve their own path, because, Fishbone basically did their own thing and they've, been rewarded and suffered the consequences because of it. So if you're an artist or a musician, you're probably going to like the film, but if you've ever tried to do something different in life, this movie is something that might resonate with you.
Right. Now, you have Lawrence Fishburne narrating it. Is that just because of his last name? Fishbone Fishburne?
I know it's just one of those kind of lucky things that we actually have, in the sense that, Lawrence Fishburne actually has just been a longtime friend and fan of the band. Actually, in the early 80s, he was a bouncer at different punk rock clubs in Hollywood and stumbled upon this band Fishbone. He was hearing all this racket that was kind of catchy, and he went inside and he's like, wait, this is six black guys making this music? And so he was intrigued, struck a couple of conversation with them, and then their friendships continued to this day. And so we were very fortunate when he said, I'll narrate your movie, because we wanted someone with a really cool voice. And he definitely has it.
Now, we see in the movie, we're talking about the documentary Everyday Sunshine, the story of Fishbone, people in the band leaving and coming back years later. Who's in it now?
So the band is primarily made of Angelo and Norwood, lead singer and bass player, kind of two founders of the band. There's also Dirty Walt, one of the original members. He actually recently rejoined the band in the last year. He'd come to do some of the kind of original score work on the film, and he was having such a good time with the guys, they decided to keep on doing it. And then there's a current lineup of people that are just really great musicians and have joined the band in the last, 8 or 9 years. And, there's Rocky George from Suicidal Tendencies and a couple of other people. And so in some ways, Fishbone is kind of evolved in different ways. And so while it's not all the original members, they're all guys that, grew up on Fishbone and so kind of continue the legacy and, I guess, the kind of aesthetic that's there. In fact, the band just had a new album come out a month ago, so they're still out there writing and doing new songs, too.
Excellent. Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is do you hope that, or do they hope that this documentary will contribute to their ongoing success as a band? Because, I mean, it's not like this is it's historical, but, I mean, they're still around. Are they hoping that they'll become more successful because of the documentary?
Well, I think that's always kind of a fair question. I mean, when they got involved in the film, they didn't do it for any kind of ulterior purposes. They kind of just, in fact, they didn't even really want to make the documentary because they're like, well, documentaries are for people who are dead,
Right.
And they're like, look, we're out there having a good time. But they saw an earlier film of mine that was a little bit offbeat and weird, and they said, well, maybe you might get this band, Fishbone. And so they welcomed us, into their lives and just said, look, you guys are artists. You're going to make your own film, and then we'll look forward to seeing it. They're obviously very happy with it. And as now the film has, opened in Los Angeles and New York, and we're on this kind of theatrical tour where we'll hit about 75 cities over the next couple months. I think new people have been brought to their concerts, whether it be people who've seen the film and said, "Oh, that's a really cool band," or people who maybe saw them 20 years ago and didn't even realize they were around. And so, in some ways, obviously, they want to be able to share their music with people, and the film has wound up being kind of a nice way to kind of reintroduce people to Fishbone. And so they're happy about it. They don't really have any expectations because they're going to do whatever they're going to do. And if there's positive benefits, then I think they're happy.
Chris Metzler is director of the documentary Everyday Sunshine, The Story of Fishbone. It opens at the CCA in Santa Fe this Friday, and also at the Guild Cinema in Albuquerque and the Taos Center for the Arts all this weekend. Chris Metzler, thanks for being with us, and let's go out with some music by Fishbone.
Most definitely, and just to let you know, I'll be doing Q&As at CCA on Saturday and Sunday, and I'll be doing the Q&As in Albuquerque on Friday. So I'll be in town and looking forward to hanging out with folks.
Excellent.
Cause there's money here to save. town that is far away. The toilet is flushed, and green lights are gold, and dark bills will be in sleek. The place is not as young, and I know what they've done. Soon as just one senator does a crawl.
And that was Fishbone with Party at Ground Zero. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Gene Medeiros. He is adjunct faculty and post-production supervisor at the Santa Fe Community College Film Program. And Stu Goswick, he is host of CinemaScope on KSFR, and he is a film mentor at the SFCC Film Program. And the Santa Fe Community College Film Program Winter Student Showcase is this coming Monday, December 12th, at 6 o'clock at the St. Francis Auditorium at the New Mexico Museum of Art. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure being here.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you back. Now, the student film program is something that, and we talked about this the last time you were on, Gene, it's something that we don't know whether to greet with enthusiasm or trepidation.
Yes, I totally understand that point of view. We do have some quality controls. The show is juried, which means that every class, the students themselves vote for the best three projects produced by each of those production classes. So there's 10 production classes. Each one will put about 3 to 4, depending on length, pieces into the showcase. So we'll have about 30 pieces that the students themselves juried as being exceptional. Most of them are limited in length to between 3 and 5 minutes, or in terms of attention span. If the clunker does get through, it won't be on the screen that long. But
Right. From
what I've seen, I've already been collecting the movie files to put the show together. This one's going to be better than any of the ones we've had previously. It's just looking amazing.
So when you were teaching film and both of you are there with the students, what kind of ideas are you seeing and then putting those ideas on film, turning them into reality? That's a tricky process.
Yes, even though we have different specialties, we do have to. Film is always collaborative. Even if you're in editing class, you're going to have to get someone with a camera or learn to do camera work. And we have several different disciplines. I focus a lot on narrative. I like a story in my film. We have a documentary segment where they portray, you know, give us information on something. A lot of students do art film. They do either totally innovative or experimental images. So there's a fairly large range. We do provide faculty in just about every area, though, that if a student wants to go in a certain direction, they have people they can bounce ideas off of.
I think that's one of the charms of this screening, is that the total range of both content and the, if I may say, the age range of the students in the program. They even excel to ages such as mine, so from just out of high school right on up. So a lot of
such as yours, we won't say exactly what that is, but basically sort of
aged,
18 to
infirm.
Retirement.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the wonderful thing about community college is you get the whole gamut.
Now, do we have anything other than zombie movies this year?
Actually, we don't have a single zombie movie
really? This
year. It's amazing.
They sort of played that theme out last time?
Well, actually, even last semester, even though that was my dread, even last semester I wasn't handed any zombie films. So it's really nice. This year we have everything. We have some amazing film from the... Because we have the master's program, so we have high school students as well. So we have some amazing films written by high school students. And then we have retirees, like one that's a graphic designer who has retired from doing that, has now gone into film. His is beautiful because of the experience and the talent that he had when he was earning his living as a graphic designer. He's a still photographer, and now he's transferred into moving pictures.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I would say that what I've seen so far is a bigger focus on narrative. The students are picking up the art of telling a complete story arc in the time allowed, in their 3 to 5 minutes. And then because we have such a strong cinematography program, that's Monique O'Neart, who was here with me last time. She teaches the cinematography portion.
Right.
And Doug Crawford, who's also a cinematography mentor, and he's, you know, Emmy Award winning cinematographer. These things look amazing.
That's incredible. So what are some of the themes that they're working with?
Well, we have, let's see, there's a young man who goes from being a graffiti artist to being an architect. There is a wonderfully well-done romantic piece about two people who meet in a discotheque, and there's a great twist, which I won't give away, as to why it's all subtitled, and you don't actually hear any dialogue, and there's a reason for that. It's a great twist at the end of the film. There's an introspective piece by a gentleman, an older gentleman, who lived through Vietnam, and that's where he lost his innocence. And he has the most moving narration of looking back at himself as a young man in Vietnam from his position of maturity today. So it's quite a gamut.
And Gene, tell them about the two major productions that the Advanced Film Crew produced this year.
Thank you. Yes, our Film Crew 3 program always produces two select student scripts, and they're done with the full support of the school. So it's total crew. Stu, as a union mentor, helps make sure that the set is run as professionally as possible. It's a great learning experience. And this year we have two films, one of which takes place at a wake for a kind of eccentric character who has passed away, and it's a young man's coming-of-age story. And the second film is a little romantic comedy set in a diner, and it's the two, the human protagonists are interspersed between two flies that are like living on coffee cups and zooming around. Their life is cut back and forth between the mirroring of their life with the lives of the humans involved. So they're both charming, they're both quite funny, and they're both very well done.
Do you use real talking flies?
No, we could not find... We even have a short sci-fi segment, but the flies did not mutate as we were hoping they would. So no one was able to speak, so we do use voiceover.
Ah.
But we do have live flies and puppet flies, and it's amazing, the combination of the two.
I would think that students, especially the young people who really came up watching movies with the most extraordinary special effects, which is what comes out of Hollywood, confronted with the limitations of a college classroom. I mean, how do they deal with, do you see people wanting to try special effects, but they can't, that they're limited?
Oh, yeah, sure. There's always, students will have a vision in their mind of effects that they may be beyond what we can do here, because we don't have the proprietary software of Hollywood. But some of us have theater backgrounds, and we do have things. We have very creative people, and we come up with workarounds for when they want a visual effect. And puppetry and 3D and stop motion animation and traditional 2D animation, these are all valid. And one thing that I really love is when we show a film and it's got theatricality in it. There's a charm that even lights up the faces of the adolescents that are used to, you know, Transformers and way over the top visual effects. And of course, we also have a real good focus on the story, which then transcends however we got the effect.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one remembers when one starts watching a lot of foreign films that the story is what it's all about and not necessarily the special effects. We just talked a few minutes ago to Chris Metzler about his film Everyday Sunshine, about this group Fishbone. And one of the things I forgot to ask him about was they used, for the parts of the film where they didn't have footage, they used animation. And just the animation, it's such a beautiful way of dealing with the reality of what you've got, which is you don't have footage of a certain time. Okay, what are we going to do?
It has a certain element of magic to any film. I remember the film Frida, Selma Hayek's film on Frida Kahlo.
Which was the worst film ever made in the history of the universe, I'm sorry.
Well, they couldn't afford to go to New York City, so that particular segment of the film, if you remember, was all cutouts and animation because they actually didn't have the budget.
It was still the worst film ever made.
Why? What didn't you like about it?
Oh, this is, we'll talk about that off
okay.
The air.
Personally, anything Selma Hayek is in, I'm there.
Well, yeah, fine, but you can just look at the pictures.
Right. I'm staying out of this one because I'm also very opinionated, but I don't have an opinion on this film.
But we digress.
We digress. We're talking about the Santa Fe Community College Film Program Winter Student Showcase, which is on Monday at 6 o'clock at the Museum of the New Mexico Museum of Art at the St. Francis Auditorium.
The thing we're excited about is that we have much increased capacity for the audience. We have been very blessed at having this screening at the screen, on the campus of Santa Fe University of Art and Design in previous semesters, but our attendance outstripped the capacity of the theater. So now we have more than doubled, I think, our capacity at the St. Francis Auditorium.
Yes.
So we really want to encourage the public to attend.
Yes, it is free, and it's open to everyone. You don't have to have a friend or a child enrolled at the college. It's open
right.
to everyone. Please, to come in and see the films that are being put
yeah,
on.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people, especially, I mean, I don't know how New Mexico views itself right now as... I mean, we used to talk about New Mexico's burgeoning film industry, and now we're not sure what to call it.
Well, you know, on my show, I take every opportunity to reinforce the fact that we're talking media, not just motion pictures, not just film. As a matter of fact, the term film is becoming less and less adequate because it's a digital age. But we are training students to compete in a media-influenced society. And where can you go? What kind of business can you go to that's not influenced by moving pictures and cameras and the internet and the web? So I think that's the more important issue of what we're training these students to manipulate that information.
And you're really yeah. training students to be professionals in the field.
Absolutely.
Yes, but in all kinds of different disciplines. I mean, mm-hmm. it's very compartmentalized out there. You can specialize in just one thing, animation or special effects. So we do give them exposure to all of that. But as I mentioned earlier, we had an older student who had retired from still photography and graphic design because it's dead. It was really hard for him to earn a living with
right.
that because a secretary now can do publisher and can send out flyers. And a lot of companies don't spend a lot of money on an art department anymore. But you don't see anything nowadays that doesn't have 3D animation or some kind of movement in it.
Right, exactly. Gene Madeira. Let me just fix that. Or let's see, I'll just... Gene Medeiros is on faculty at Santa Fe Community College Film Programs. Stu Gostwick is a film mentor there and is the host of CinemaScope, which airs on KSFR on Friday nights at 6:30, and the SFCC Winter Showcase Monday at 6 o'clock, St. Francis Auditorium, New Mexico Museum of Art. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was very good for you to have us on.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. We'll be right back. Listening to the song Heavy the Rain by Angela Bivens, singer-songwriter who joins us here in the cafe. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
So you, Angela, have been on the show a number of times before, I think, and you have your debut album, which is being released this Sunday. It's called White Dragon. So tell us about the process of, I mean, you're a teacher of music and of voice, and you've been singing and performing, but getting to that point where you have a professionally produced CD that's out there.
Wow, getting to this point. Well, definitely a journey. I have recorded albums in the past, but this was the first time that I went into a studio. I went to Ceremony Studios here in Santa Fe and worked with Bob Witzenhausen. And he was able to draw out the motivation, the energy that I needed to see this through. I've been wanting to do it for a long time, and I had somebody in town offer to pay for the album for me. So that's how I was able to do it.
Very nice.
And I'm really excited it's done. I think of this album as kind of an internship.
What do you mean?
Like, it's very educational, the process for me. I'm also now looking forward to doing another album.
So you play piano, and that's you, right, playing?
Yes.
So when you record, are you recording every track separately? Are you there? You're not playing and singing at the same time, or are you?
I'm not, and that is actually really different for me. I am used to playing and singing at the same time, the emotional component weaving in and out with my fingers, with my voice, with the meaning of the words. And this was a very different process, having to lay the piano track down, having to lay the vocal track down, and having to feel the emotion from it. Also choosing, how is this arrangement going to be? What other artists are we going to bring in?
And so that is itself is kind of part of the art and craft, as opposed to the sort of spontaneous getting up on stage in front of a live audience and you're live with all your musicians and yourself and you give everything you've got at
yes.
one time.
Yeah, and actually that I've thought about that a lot, because the way that the album was produced, it has a different sound than when I play live. And actually at the event coming up, I will be playing live. And it will be me and piano, so it will be more of an acoustic, bare bones versions of the song.
Your album release party is this Sunday from 4 to 6 at the El Dorado Hotel, and you're going to be performing and hanging out. It's been kind of a community process of getting this whole thing made.
Yes, like I said, I had a person in town offer to pay for studio time for the album, which is how that was feasible. I also joined Kickstarter.com and raised over $4,000 to press the CD and have the release party.
Nice.
So a lot of people from the community donated and pledged. And this event is really to celebrate all of that effort and the culmination into the album.
You're playing piano, but you've got a number of other musicians playing the other instruments on the album.
I do. I hired some local musicians. Josh Martin played bass on most of the songs. A friend of mine, Tim Masika, played electric guitar. Russell Scharf played trumpet on a few tracks. Sharon Gilchrist played mandolin on the title track, White Dragon. And Bob Witzenhausen played percussion.
Very nice. Now, you also, besides performing and making albums and all this, you teach piano and you teach voice.
I do. I have a studio called Another Bird of Song. And I'm located down on Palace Avenue. I have piano, voice, and composition lessons, and I've been doing it for about 5 years. And I'm always accepting new students. And it's really nice. The students who are attracted to me are students that are they're very creative inherently. They have a songwriting aspect part of them, and I help to draw that out.
Very interesting. So you're not only teaching them technique, you're teaching them to compose their own music.
To connect with their muse.
Yeah.
And to transform their life experiences, their emotions into music.
What is that process like for you, contacting that muse, so to speak?
It's always there for me. And, you know, that really lends itself to what I want to say about the album, that each song is a transformation of an experience, a life lesson. And so that muse is always at work for me, how I see things, how I'm perceiving, how I'm trying to transform whatever experience to lend itself to be the highest good for me or for all.
Angela Bivens is a singer-songwriter. Her debut album is called White Dragon, and once again, she will be at the El Dorado Hotel from 4 to 6 this coming Sunday, the 11th of December. It's a party to which the public is invited.
Yes, I hope to see you there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be with you, too.
We're going to take another little break. Keith McHenry will join us in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy to welcome back to the program Keith McHenry. His new book is called Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on the show. And this is a wonderful book. It's both a history of food, not bombs. And we're going to do a longer show when you're back in town next week. But we wanted to let you announce there's actually, what is it, a book signing?
Yeah, it's a book signing and book opening at the Taos Public Library. And it's co-sponsored by the library and Taos Food Not Bombs on Saturday, December 10th. And it's at 2:30 in the afternoon after our meal, which we usually serve at the Taos Plaza from noon to 2. And it's actually the anniversary of my first presentation in Taos years ago when I first moved there. I did a presentation. That's Human Rights Day, and so I try to make a point of doing something in Taos on Human Rights Day just to mark it and to show the connection between Food Not Bombs and the broader ideas of human rights.
And so Food Not Bombs basically not only feeds the hungry with food that's available, a lot of times food that's been thrown away, but also then cultivates discussions about what's going on socially, politically.
Right. That's the idea originally when we first started in 1980. You know, Reagan had just come to power, and so the concern was that he would institute economic policies that would divert resources from human needs towards military spending, and that would be damaging to the population, and that the people might end up having to stand in line to eat at soup kitchens if those policies were to happen. So we were more of
And lo and behold.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? 30 years of Reaganomics now, and the struggle in Congress and in the national election is all about the same issues. And somehow for the Republican Party to say that Reaganomics has really worked, when I myself personally can see that I was handing out free vegan meals on the streets of Boston and Cambridge as a political statement, and not because there was really all that many homeless and hungry people needing to eat in 1980 when Food Not Bombs happened. There was still poverty. In that case, our focus was taking food to housing projects, to public housing. But since that time, public housing has been gutted. And so it's actually now people think of us as a group that is feeding the homeless. But the reality is we're trying to get everyone there, homeless or not homeless, to hang out and discuss different political ideas for just or other ideas, artistic ideas, any kind of things that people are inspired to discuss, and to spend 2 or 3 hours with us in a city corner somewhere enjoying food and having discussions about the future of the world or whatever is important to people at that time. And so for 30 years we've done that, and an occasion of the conversation will just lead to social change in a major way. The most amazing thing was I visited Iceland, and I've got some photos in the book about Iceland and some reference to what they're doing there. That meal was the only public meal. You don't go out in the middle of Reykjavik and hang out and eat normally. But people would come by and eat. At first they ridiculed us because the country, they said, look, we don't have poor and homeless here. Within months, the economy of Iceland collapsed. That weekly conversation led to protest marches to the parliament building about 2 blocks away. Eventually, the weekly Saturday Food Not Bombs meal resulted in inspiring the change of government. And they were one of the first governments to refuse to bail out their banks because of public pressure. And Food Not Bombs played a huge role in that.
Keith McHenry is author of the new book, Hungry for Peace, How You Can Help End Poverty and War with Food Not Bombs. And once again, you will be at the Taos Public Library this Saturday at what time?
It's at 2:30.
At 2:30 in the afternoon. And we're going to have you back because we want to talk more about the book in much more detail next week. So on Tuesday of next week, we'll have you back on the show. But meanwhile, we'll see you at the Taos Public Library this Saturday afternoon.
Thanks so much for having us. That's great.
Thanks.
Mary Charlotte, great.
And Scott Sugar will join us in just a moment. We're going to take another little break. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome to the program Scott Sugar. He is a local artist, and his one-man show, How Right You Are, is being performed at Eggman and Walrus this Friday and Saturday, December 9th and 10th at 7:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me on once again.
So You wrote this, and I haven't seen you rehearse it yet, but I've read the script. It's kind of, if I may say so, a rant against the Tea Party. Is that right?
That's quite accurate, I will say.
And what made you write it?
Well, several months ago, I was challenged for an independent study that I'm doing with UNM. I'm actually a full-time fine arts major, and I will be graduating on the 16th. And I decided to do an independent study towards my degree, and I'm working with a local theater person, and we came up with this idea to do a performance art piece. I wrote several scripts on various topics that, shall we say, were satires. And when we both looked at the scripts, we went, neither one of us were excited about it. But one of the ideas that I had was doing some kind of spoof on the Tea Party. And because I am, shall we say, the polar opposite of the Tea Party politically and values-wise, I thought that would be a fun thing to do. So what we decided to do is expand that idea into a four-part single-person show. There'll be four monologues, each with a various stereotype of not just a Tea Party. You could say the Tea Party represents a sort of values-driven consciousness that exists in our country, which is mainly that our broken country, as you might say, can be fixed by returning to basic American values, which supposedly the United States was founded upon. And unfortunately, a lot of those values, implied or explicit, happen to be about white supremacy and self-sufficiency, rugged individualism, return to Christian values, conservative Christian values. So I...
To the extent that it is really even a return to those things, I mean, you have to get it kind of deep into history to talk about whether or not the image of the founding fathers in the minds of the people you're talking about is really accurate.
Yeah, my understanding of the so-called founding fathers is that they were known as deists, which were people who acknowledged a supreme being, but they were far from religious. They actually were not associated with any particular church. They just considered themselves to be deists. But
And there was also some diversity among them.
Of course. And, you know, if you can even say that one of the founding principles of this country was religious tolerance. But we still have this dominant evangelical Christian mindset because so many changes have happened in the United States since that time that these conservative forces simply cannot accept. And so now we see movements like the Tea Party that has its own brand of diversity, but a lot of the movement has individuals that are calling for things like a return to Christian values as they define them, the sanctity of the Second Amendment.
Oh yeah, that's really Christian.
You're right. Yeah, and there's always this disconnect or this irony around, like, let's stop abortion with guns. You know?
So you wrote all of this. Now, is the writing in your piece, how right you are, based on texts or speeches that you've found, or
yeah. Now, you know, I'll caveat and say that I've never been to a Tea Party rally. I really don't know anybody that's in it. You know, we do live in Santa Fe. It's not a very strong movement, but there is a Tea Party that I've recognized.
Yeah, there's a Tea Party here.
There is. And so most of my research was done through media, through television media, through research that I found on the internet. I went to several sites that had their platforms listed.
It's based on the ideas that you find.
Yes, yes.
Kind of in the public domain.
Others' blogs, their opinions about it. You know, some were just opinions, some were facts. A lot of imagery that I found online, like actual protest signs. A lot of them you find.
Some of those are really, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I mean not to be, and I'm not saying this in a partisan way, but it is. A gold mine of grammatical problems.
Exactly. And I incorporate that into my show, by the way. So, yeah, you could say that in the way the Tea Party is a gift to liberal comedy.
Now, you wrote this before the Occupy movement got underway. Does it feel different now that the political dialogue of this country has somewhat shifted?
True. It has. It has. It's quite interesting because for so long I've been feeling just this, you know, what they call liberal burnout, where I just feel like we just keep losing and losing and losing, and you know, all the progress that's been made over the past couple of centuries is really has been really losing ground, to the point where I even wonder where the Tea Party came from. Why do they even need to exist since they're winning all the time? When the Occupy movement started, I too became involved in it, and it's sort of made the piece more relevant, maybe, or more dear to my heart in a way. I'm really not shooting for like to make one bad and one good. It's
well, you kind of are. I mean,
well,
I was going to ask you if you found the positive side of the Tea Party in doing this, like if you found some sympathetic humanity on the side that you were parodying.
Well, in some ways there are some things with the Tea Party that I agree with, that the government is too big, it's too powerful. There's a lot of government waste, there's a lot of government bureaucracy. It has infiltrated the lives of ordinary citizens for reasons that make no sense. I think where we part company is that the reason they want to shrink the size of government is so people don't have to share things, so that there doesn't have to be any law enforcement, so that people can, whoever has the most guns and the most money can basically do what they want. It seems to be like more of a form of social Darwinism based on these old values of rugged individualism, when someone could move out west and get their own piece of land and not be bothered by anyone. Well, the world's changed a lot more since then. And we're seeing a lot in the Tea Party movement, this anti-immigration faction, that in my own research has just been blatantly racist, that a fear of the white race becoming somehow losing its dominance. And that is of great concern to me. I've seen some of this Tea Party literature that is just blatantly racist against President Obama. I'm actually not a big fan of Obama, but I think demeaning him because of his race is very regressive and blatantly racist, and some of it was actually quite appalling to me, to be honest.
Scott Shuker's performance is called How Right You Are, and it's being performed at Eggman and Walrus at 130 West Palace Avenue here in Santa Fe on Friday and Saturday at 7:30. And for more information, you can call 505-988-4157. Everyone is invited. Low, low price. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Mayor Charlotte.